This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. When talking about corporate mergers, business reporters and analysts love to use the metaphor of marriage. Procter & Gamble ties the knot with Gillette. MetLife takes Travelers Life for better or worse. Kmart and Sears agree to have and to hold each other, all very optimistic and rosy, like the start of any new relationship. But sometimes there are breakups and discord. Just today, the CEO of Hewlett-Packard resigned. Carly Fiorina, one of the few women to lead a Fortune 500 company, stepped down 3 years after spearheading HP's acquisition of Compaq Computer. And remember the dissolution of the much-heralded AOL-Time Warner marriage? Like most relationships, mergers have their ups and downs, and right now, Wall Street is experiencing a dizzying high. Today on the show, we'll talk about why this mania to merge is happening now, if it's different from the last wave of consolidations in the 90s, and what effect mergers have on shareholders, consumers, and employees. We'd especially like to hear from people whose companies have gone through a merger. What was it like? Did it affect morale? Did it affect your job? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email is totn@npr.org. With us to talk about the business world's seeming obsessions with mergers at the moment is Matthew Bishop, business editor for The Economist magazine. He joins us from his office in London. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's good to be with you.
So what is driving the current push for mergers that we seem to be reading about?
Well, I think there are two main drivers of this current mania. The first is that really confidence has returned to corporate America, to the boardroom. You know, the last few years, because of the backlash against bosses that followed the Enron scandal and the WorldCom scandal, most bosses thought the most prudent thing would be to keep their heads below the radar, to do nothing that would get them headlines, and just concentrate on rebuilding their profitability. Now they seem to be getting the confidence to go and do new things. Their profits are at fantastically high levels, record-breaking levels, and they feel, okay, we've redeemed ourselves. Now we can go on a bit of an adventure. So that's one reason, return of confidence. The second reason is that you know, there are actually a number of industries that have too much capacity, too many firms, too many people in the industry. And by merging, you can take out some of that capacity, reduce your costs, make yourself more efficient, and therefore, you know, boost profits even further. And I think some of those recent mergers, like the P&G Gillette merger and the SBC takeover of AT&T, both fit into that classification.
So is there, on the surface, a kind of a merger that seems to be better suited than some other? I mean, because I would have thought some of the things you were talking about of the AOL Time Warner, they were both companies with communications expertise, albeit in different parts of the communications world. So it's not clear to me what the basis of, you know, a promising merger is.
Well, I mean, there are two things that can really go wrong in a merger. The first is that you simply pay far too much money for something that's quite sensible to buy. You know, there's no way you could ever make that deal a sensible deal. And that often happens at the peak of stock markets, where managers just get carried away. They must have that company. They will pay whatever it takes to get there. Now, the other type is where you do something, where you have a strategy for the merger, and the strategy proves to be much harder to execute than you thought it would be. And I think if you look back over a half a century or more of merger activity, you see that the simpler the strategy, the more likely it is for the merger to be a success. And the simplest strategy is when you have two firms that are very similar to each other and there's a lot of duplication. You put the two firms together, take out the duplication, and you increase your profitability. Even a deal like AOL Time Warner, you say they're the same industry, but essentially Time Warner had a lot of content, magazines, TV programs and so forth. It didn't have delivery to the internet, and it basically felt under huge pressure to get into that internet business. At the time, the bubble was very strong, and so they managed to merge with AOL absolutely at the peak of the bubble, and that proved to be an absolutely disastrous merger because there was really no simple strategy to make those two firms improve each other's profitability.
Well, what about then HP and Compaq? I mean, those seem to be even closer aligned in what they were both attending and intending, and it seemed like there was a room for, you know, streamlining and reduction of overlap, but that didn't seem to be working so well.
Yeah, a couple of things there. I mean, one is that that actually the culture of the two companies that merge, you know, is the thing that often gets ignored by bosses. They think we're more or less similar, we can take out the cost. But then you realize one company, you know, has this very close culture that everyone thinks they've got a job for life. This is Hewlett Packard. And there was just tremendous internal pain when the two companies merged and all those people had to be fired. And so that just undermined any sensible strategy that was there. The second thing is that actually, you know, even if you've got two firms that are struggling, two wrongs don't make a right. And you basically in the computer industry have Dell that's coming in and eating everyone's lunch. And even a merger is not going to save you from that problem.
Right. Okay. Well, let's hear some of the experiences and opinions of our callers. And let's first go to Ted in Jacksonville, Florida. Ted, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for taking my call. I was just telling the screener that I was part of a merger, and it went extremely well. Not one person lost their job. As your guest said, the strategy was simple. There was great focus, an entirely brand new set of mission statements. And I got to tell you, it was good. It was a win-win for all of us at the two companies and eventually the customer.
Can you say which companies?
Yes, it was Federal Express and what was Caliber Systems, the old RPS / now FedEx Ground.
So, and just, I'm not familiar, but FedEx was much larger than RPS, wasn't it, or was it?
That's correct.
So let me ask Matthew Bishop, is that one of the qualities that makes for a successful merger when a big company can sort of devour a smaller one that it can integrate more easily?
Yes, I think you see a lot of those sorts of mergers where you have a company like FedEx or like Microsoft, who I think is probably one of the great exponents of those sort of deals. It notices that it has a little niche business where it doesn't have a presence. It wants to be in that business. It sees the best firm out there, and it's willing to pay top dollar to acquire that firm and fit it in neatly. And often it will want to keep the talent in the firm it buys, and so it's very generous in the way it does it. There aren't the layoffs that you see in some of these other mergers. The other issue is that what we know is that mergers of equals, or supposedly mergers of equals, where it's not clear who's in charge, they tend to be the most difficult to pull off because you get all this squabbling in the boardroom. And so, again, when you have a big firm buy a little tiny firm, there's no question that that's a merger of equal. So no one gets confused about who's in charge.
Right. Ted, thanks so much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go on to Sharon in Baltimore, Maryland. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
The reason I'm calling is I was involved with the merger with Royal Ahold and Giant Food Incorporated.
Those are big supermarket chains.
Yes, they are. Uh-huh. Actually, I started with the company back in '63, and I have just recently retired because of the atmosphere that was in the store and the unspoken words of, you know, well, we're not going to fire anyone, we're not going to get rid of anyone, but the push behind the jobs and what you are required to do in the past and what changes with the requirements of the new regime is so, you know, it's so large that no one either grasps what's going on or they just don't know where they're going with it.
So was it clear who was calling the shots after the merger?
No, it was not. The store managers and up the pecking system, no one really knows what's going on. You know, you try to get some information as to, well, who's your boss? Well, who's his boss? Nobody knows. Well, this one, you know, comes from Royal Ahold. Oh, well, that's a Giant thing. Well, it was just ridiculous. You couldn't make any headway whatsoever.
All right.
The only redeeming factor was we were union.
Yeah. Yeah, and that would give you a lot of voice, I suppose.
And yes, and
okay.
They were very active in my store.
Okay. Okay. Sharon, thanks for that call. I just wonder if I could ask Matthew Bishop. So Royal Ahold was, a Dutch company, and mm-hmm. Giant was a U.S. company. Are there special problems when you've got a company from one country buying one in another country?
Well, I think there are. That particular deal, I think, ended up in a lot of scandal because of accounting irregularities and maybe other things going on in the American subsidiary, which has landed the Dutch bosses got fired and all sorts of things went wrong there. And I think that highlights this problem that actually a foreign company coming in and buying doesn't really know what it's necessarily buying, and particularly when you have an accounting system that, as we all discovered over the past few years, is not terribly accurate in America. You really find a lot of companies buy something they don't know what they bought. They suddenly discover something's wrong there, and then, of course, they are under enormous pressure from their own shareholders to sort it out quickly, and that's when you tend to get them behaving in quite a ruthless way and very short-termist way and then doing all sorts of damage so that they end up with a company that's worth a lot less than it would have been had they not bought it.
Is there anything like that happening with the Daimler-Benz Chrysler merger?
Well, not that I'm aware of, but I think in that case it was simply that the Germans thought they had a much better company than they really acquired. They seem to not understand the dynamics of the American car market, which, as we know, is ruthlessly competitive and characterized by lots of big firms willing to cut prices all the time and aren't very interested in making profits, as far as one can tell.
And is there ego? I mean, you were starting to say, is there certain pride in look, we're a German company and we were able to buy a U.S. company? Does that enter into it?
Oh, I'm sure that was the case with that particular deal. And ego is a huge factor. At the moment, probably because of what I said about the atmosphere in the boardrooms of America, you can't be too egotistical as a boss. You've really got to make the case to your board on strategic and profit grounds. But I imagine once we get a couple more years into the merger wave, you'll start to see empire builders emerging and buying all sorts of companies they really shouldn't be buying because they quite like the headquarters building or whatever.
We're talking about the recent spate of corporate mergers. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk with a professor who studies the effect of mergers on consumers. Call us at 800-989-TALK or send email totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking with business editor Matthew Bishop of The Economist about why some corporate marriages work and why others don't. You can tell us about the fallout you may have experienced in a merger. Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we've been talking about what these mergers mean for the world of business, but what do they mean for the consumer? Joining us to talk about that is Klaus Fornell. He's a professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He also heads up the university's American Customer Satisfaction Index. Professor Fornell is with us from studios on the Ann Arbor campus. Welcome.
Nice to be with you.
So what have your studies learned about the effect of mergers have on consumers? Are the consumers happier or not, or do they don't even notice?
No, they do notice. Most mergers leave customers less satisfied. And as a result, at least in some measures, shareholders lose as well. There have been tremendous loss in shareholder wealth for the last merger activity of any note between 1995 and 2000. I've seen estimates up to $1 trillion lost. And a good deal of this is probably due to the fact that something is going on with the customer base. We find, looking at our data, that high levels of customer satisfaction and shareholder value go together. Now, that's pretty obvious when you think about it. Satisfied customers tend to provide more repeat business and generate a stable income stream. Now, in terms of both revenue and profit, most of it then comes from repeat business. And repeat business, in turn, is obviously highly dependent upon having satisfied customers. So if your customers are not satisfied, they will go elsewhere.
So, but what I don't understand is if I go buy a Chrysler car, What difference does it make to me in my satisfaction if the Chrysler car company is owned in part by a company in Germany, or if I go to Giant Food, you know, to do shopping, whether it matters, you know, how my satisfaction depends on whether the company is owned locally or in Holland?
Oh, that doesn't matter at all. Oh,
okay.
That doesn't matter at all. What matters here, and we can take a few examples, is that, and I think this is interesting, we have most of these situations are firms that are not spectacular in satisfying the customers. Kmart and Sears will be one example. The one you mentioned, Daimler-Benz and Chrysler, another. Hewlett-Packard and Compact, yet another. These are firms, save HP, which actually had quite good satisfaction scores until recently, but they went after, they acquired firms that were usually not doing well with the customers, and that dragged them down. Now, having established that, we can go on and say, what happened here, and why is that? It's not because one firm happened to be in Germany, another in Holland, and then a third one in the United States. But usually what happens is cost-cutting and streamlining, leading to fewer alternatives, be they brands or retail outlets, and then forgetting what was at least part of the focus, or should have been the focus, of the merger in the first place, the customers or the larger customer base, and the difficulties in coordinating and get people to work together seem to suck up all the energy, and then the customers are not being treated right. And if you talk about product companies like Daimler Chrysler, it turns out that the quality of the vehicles are not as good.
Well, let's hear what our callers have to say on this topic, and let's go to Neil in Chicago. Neil, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Hello.
Yeah, I actually work for British Telecom, BT, and we recently did two joint ventures, one with MCI originally, and then one with AT&T, and we've now bought Infinet, so we're doing the same sort of thing that SBC is doing with AT&T. And what I found is that if there's no synergies between the companies, then what ends up happening is that you take on what's known as a lumbering giant. British Telecom took on AT&T and found that I actually found AT&T's processes were so, because they're an old Marbell, their processes were so laborious that BT couldn't actually work with them, and obviously the joint venture we had actually exploded. But I'd like to point out, I'd like to put a question to the people you've got.
Sure.
Is the fact that will the SBC-AT&T merger work, and do you think there's enough clout that SBC have got over AT&T to turn around and say, okay, then we're going to revamp your processes and bring them way up to date?
Neil, thanks very much for that question. Matthew Bishop, SBC is the baby bell that was spun off, or one of the baby bells that was spun off when the AT&T broke up, and now it's large enough to come back and buy AT&T. What do you think about that merger?
Well, I think your caller makes a very important point, although I think on paper it looks quite a good deal, and AT&T has supposedly been preparing itself to be bought for some time. People I know who work there speak about its culture being laborious, to say the least, and so therefore one has to question whether it's really going to be able to change enough to be the attractive purchase that SBC thinks it has, but only time will tell. I mean, it's the trouble with, you know, a very old and venerable company that is still trying to come to terms with not being the big kid on the block. You know, will it be able to cope with that, with being subsumed into a former offspring?
Klaus Fornell, I wonder if you can see any, you know, hazards, or is there a key to making this merger work, in your opinion?
Well, there's always a risk, and if history is a guide, it's very, very difficult. Most of these mergers don't work out all that well. But here's one that might. I would say the same thing about Procter & Gamble and Gillette. But the reason it might work out is that I think the analysis had been done well beforehand here, in terms of looking at what the resulting balance sheet may look like after a merger. Now, remember that the capital invested obviously goes up, and in many cases dramatically so. So even if the profits after the merger may look okay, that profit may, and it, this is usually the case, be very expensive to get to in terms of the capital used. So the return on capital will be a key here, but it seems to me, not knowing that much about it, I must admit, that this could possibly be an exception that does not follow the rule.
All right, let's take another call, and maybe we can go to Kevin in Sacramento, California. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your what's your experience with mergers?
Well, I found your program very interesting today. My experience is actually as a spouse. My wife works for a large, well-known regional bank in California. But prior to that, she worked for a regional bank in the Midwest, and there was essentially a merger of equals between the two. However, the merger has turned out extremely well, primarily from the fact that I think there was a clear strategy on the part of both management teams that after the merger was completed, the vision for the new resulting bank after the merger was really going to be defined by just one set of management teams, one management team, and that team essentially did take over the bank and is still running it today. And needless to say, it's been a great success story. And coming from the Sacramento area, I can also relate to the Hewlett-Packard story. A lot of our friends in this area worked for that company, and it's been somewhat of a different story and certainly a different psychology among the workers compared to, say, my wife's bank. So,
okay, interesting point, Kevin. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Mary, let's try. Let's go to Mary in Napa Knee, Indiana. Mary, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for letting me be on your show. the reason I'm calling is because all these mergers that seem to be happening in the last while, my mind happens to go to Walmart when Walmart kind of cornered the superstore market. And I remember when Walmart first came out, you could go in there and it was like, wow, there was someone right there to help you. And now it seems like, well, one time I timed it, I waited for 45 minutes with all the people that work at a Walmart. And it seems like when people merge, the quality of customer service goes down. For instance, I tried calling HP one time and I got someone overseas and couldn't hardly understand what they were saying. When it's an assistance.
Yeah.
And it seems like the quality is going down and that the customer is suffering for it. And a question that I would have is, where is the competition going to come from? If everyone's merging and we have these big companies, for instance, Walmart would have like 150% markup, which a friend of mine that works there had told me. So where is the competition coming from?
Well, interesting point, and maybe I can ask Matthew Bishop, whether this, whether the trend is that there's only like three companies left. I mean, it's not going to get that far, but where does it stop?
Well, I mean, competition is clearly the key to making sure that mergers don't hurt the customer. The Walmart story really isn't a merger story. It's a story of a company that's grown very large by being extremely good value to its customers. So even though, maybe the customer service hasn't been as good as it ought to have been, the prices have certainly been very attractive, enough to grow this company very large. But at the end of the day, it's got so big that it's forced Procter & Gamble and Gillette to merge in order to be a stronger competitor to the supermarket chains. Now, you have antitrust laws in America that are very aggressive and are supposed to be very strongly in favor of the consumer. And so the question is going to be, are they really going to be strong enough if this merger wave continues to protect consumers and give them the competition they need?
All right, Matthew Bishop, thanks for that perspective from your point of view. Matthew Bishop is business editor at The Economist. He spoke to us from his office in London. Thank you. We'd like to talk now with a business executive who's been involved with several mergers during his career. Bill George is former CEO of Medtronic, a medical technology company. He now sits on the boards of Goldman Sachs, Novartis, and Target. He also teaches leadership at Harvard Business School. Right now, Bill George is on the Turks and Caicos Island in the Caribbean and joins us by phone from his hotel. Well, I guess a special thanks if you're willing to take time off from a vacation in the Turks and Caicos to talk to us.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So tell us about your experience with mergers. You've been on both ends of doing the acquiring and being acquired.
Well, at Medtronic, we had a very successful time with mergers where we're acquiring companies somewhat smaller than we were. In fact, back in 1999, we acquired six companies for a total of $9 billion, and the company's size doubled. And at the same time, the market capitalization went from $22 billion to $60 billion. I think the key, though, it is true that some 7 out of 10 mergers don't work. And I think the key is not arguing over the last dollar of stock price, which the stock market seems to think is important. It's really important is how good a cultural fit is there. Do the companies have similar mission and values, strategy, and can you sort out the organizational leadership questions? In my approaching other CEOs to join with Medtronic, these are the questions we always talked about, and we left price for later, and it was always worked out. We never got hung up on price once we had an understanding on these important issues. And I see so many mergers like AOL, Time Warner, and Daimler Chrysler, and others that have struggled mightily with leadership issues as well as cultural fit.
We're talking with Bill George. He's the former CEO of Medtronic. Also with us is Professor Klaus Fornell from the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. We're talking about mergers and how they work out. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Bill George, I wonder what the question I'd like to follow that with is, if the you said that if the philosophies are the same, can the businesses be disparate? I mean, if the companies have the same philosophy, can you merge a company that makes a medical equipment with a company that makes computers, for example?
I'm not big on that. I saw I was with Linden Industries for 10 years, and they followed a strategy that Tyco followed more recently of just merging conglomerate with companies across the board, and I don't think that works very well. In Medtronic's case, we were able to go from a pacemaker company, companies predominantly pacemakers, to the world's leading medical technology company by acquiring companies with a broad range of technologies and getting there much faster than the company ever could have gotten through internal means.
Okay. Well, let's take a call from our listeners who have been adding their perspective to this, and let's go to Quinn in Salt Lake City. Quinn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's your observation or question?
Oh, I was part of a merger and acquisition some years ago when Novell acquired WordPerfect Corporation, and they were extremely divergent cultures. And I was uniquely fortunate in having a manager who managed the merger of the two cultures in a very, I think, a very excellent way. I found it a positive experience, but many, many of my colleagues from the WordPerfect side found the Novell WordPerfect merger to be, disastrous from the cultural integration perspective.
So, but you're saying that some of the I'm not quite clear, because if some of them are happy with the cultural mix and others not, then it wasn't a good mix overall.
No, I would say, depending on who you ask, depending on, in my particular division, I would say it was an effective merger, and it was largely due to the management. They put together a task force with equal members from both sides of the Novell team and the WordPerfect team, and we put together the brand new structure of the division, and I thought that was quite effective. In other divisions of the organization, it was the ruling regime that, laid off large sections of populations, and there was a lot of bitterness, I think. So I think the previous comment about cultural aspects of mergers and acquisitions is very, very valid. That is something that I think is often overlooked, that integrating the cultures has to be handled very delicately.
Okay, Quinn. Thanks for that. Bill George, briefly, any response to that?
I agree fully with Quinn. I'm on the board of Novartis, which is the largest Swiss pharmaceutical company, which resulted from the merger of Sandoz and Ciba Geigy, two very different cultures. And Dan Vassella, the CEO, stepped up and found a way to create a new Novartis culture that brought the best of each company to the fore. Now, I'd have to say he's rather a rare exception, but it has worked extremely well, and the company has grown and prospered as a result of that, but only because they got the cultural issues sorted out very early after the merger and didn't wait to let them fester, as happened in many cases.
Klaus Fornell, is it the corporate culture? Is that important in your opinion?
Well, I think we have examples where sometimes it's extremely difficult for two individuals that could be married to one another to work together and to coordinate things. I'm not talking about myself here, but in general that's the case. Now, it seems to me that if it does not work out for the customer, it will not work out for the cultural fit or for the employees as well. Now, our system, the market economy, whether we like it or not, certainly puts the customer first. And ultimately, the job security, whether things will work or not, must depend on whether the customers are more or less satisfied and continue to buy more and pay more and so forth.
Okay. Well, Klaus Fornell, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Klaus Fornell is a professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. He spoke to us from the studios on the Ann Arbor campus. Thank you very much. And also thanks to Bill George. He's a former CEO of Medtronics. He's now a professor at Harvard Business School. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about getting stuck in call center purgatory, plus quarters with expensive flaws. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.